Canadian Wealth Wisdom by Treadle to Private Wealth. My name is Kyle Taylor, Wealth Advisor and Portfolio Manager with Treadle to Private Wealth. I am joined by Cameron Windsor, Head of Equities and Portfolio Manager of TriDelta's Growth and Pension Equity Funds. Cam has spent the past 12 years with TriDelta, but previously worked with Franklin Templeton, RBC, and Scotiabank in a career spanning almost 30 years. Cameron also obtained his CFA designation in 2004. Welcome, Cam.
Thanks, Kyle.
Before we begin, it should be noted that this podcast is intended for general information only and not specific investment advice. You should always speak to an investment professional to determine the appropriateness of any investment or investment strategy and how it relates to your specific situation. That said, the TriDelta team welcomes a conversation to learn more. The purpose of this series will be to discuss the recent market developments, what we're watching, and ultimately what action TriDelta is taking within our growth and equity pension strategies. And there's no one better to hear from than Cameron Windsor, who is our head of equities and manager of these two funds. So Cam, before we go any further, maybe you could take us through what the two equity strategies are and how they're managed.
Sure, Kyle. To take a step back, we here at TriDelta use all three major investment analysis styles to manage our equity funds: quantitative, fundamental, and technical. The primary driver behind the portfolios is quantitative screens that we use to create a list of companies with the best attributes within our mandates that have shown to have a history of outperformance. We use these screens to create a short list of buy candidates and to also help identify when stocks should be sold. We then use fundamental analysis to look through company research and see if we can find any catalysts or risks that we think could influence the future performance of the stocks. And last but not least is technical analysis, where we look for trends, support or resistance, overbought or oversold conditions, and any other technical setups to help identify the timing of buys, sells, or trims or additions. So now going down to the two specific funds, we have the pension fund, which the core mandate for pension is to look for some quality dividend paying stocks with some capital gain potential. Attributes that we look for in these stocks include the expected yield, the history of dividend growth, changes in companies' cash flows, return on equity, and return on assets. Now just a little bit on our growth fund. Personally, I think this is one of the most unique funds available, as essentially we are style agnostic. For this fund, we monitor investment styles across the Canadian and US markets and sectors. We then adjust the quantitative models used depending on the current environment we see. As an example, we're currently using a momentum strategy to pick US infotech stocks, a dividend growth strategy for our US industrials, and a value strategy for U.S. energy. The U.S. market's very broad and deep, so we're able to run the model selections at the sector level, where in Canada, we actually run only one or two models for the entire universe, just because, as I said, there's not as many stocks available out there to pick from. So currently in the growth strategy, we're using a predictable growth strategy, And we're also using some momentum to help ferret out some stocks that we think look attractive.
Great.
There as well.
And we'll certainly get into some of what that means, of course. But going a little deeper into the past 3 months, the growth equity fund returned 7.34% and 19.8% over the prior 12 months, while the pension equity fund returned 4.75% year-to-date and 9.11% over the past 12 months. Cam, we have written a lot about the wide gap between growth and value. Can you share your thoughts on how the outperformance of growth stocks compares to periods in your career you have witnessed previously, and how you're positioned today in the funds?
Thanks. Sure. But first, I'd just like to talk about two really important things when investing. First is that the market trends change and the investment community's preferences and focuses change, and that these need to be monitored. Second, earnings and valuation are what really matter in the long run. Not too long ago, when interest rates were rising, tech stocks sold off because of a narrative that they were long duration assets and rising rates were bad for these. you know, it made a great story, but ultimately earnings and valuation are what matter. And the earnings for many of these tech names continue to be strong, and their stock prices recoup their losses. So as you were mentioning, growth stocks, more specifically U.S. tech growth stocks, are currently in vogue. And for the most part, stocks with earnings growth have always been the ones that really get sought after. The sectors can change and the predicament can change. But, you know, one example I'll go back to, you know, in the years leading up to the Chinese-hosted 2008 Olympics, you know, we had a massive commodity market boom. Global investors wanted commodity stocks. At the time, I was running a U.S. growth fund at a major Canadian bank, and nobody wanted U.S. stocks. I couldn't get a meeting with a broker. They couldn't send us out for marketing for anything, because everybody really just wanted to get into commodity stocks because that's where the growth was. So you can find numerous situations across time where utility stocks can become growth stocks. Financials, if you look at in the 90s, financial stocks were a big growth stock area. But then on the opposite side of that, you kind of have, you know, the valuation for things. And that's, you know, there are times when valuations can be what the investment community is out there looking for and what is getting rewarded. So again, that's part why we do what we do, where we monitor everything to figure out when these strategies and styles are being rewarded in the market, and then we're able to act on those.
And how do you integrate a disciplined process to really take away some of the emotion that I think a lot of investors fall victim to when they're watching those high flyers kind of ride that wave, and there's that fear of missing out, of course?
Yeah, and for me, that's a weekly process, where essentially I have my systems and my screens that I go through and I look at, and you know, there's a lot of work, and you know, maybe at the end of the day 10% is actually really only relevant, but you have to go through these processes. You have to look at essentially everything, and then you know, a very small percentage actually turns out to be actionable from that.
And is it ever a little frustrating? I know we're on the back of a 10-year stretch where growth, and more specifically tech, has outperformed by a pretty wide margin at what many would call unreasonable valuations or prospects for future growth. Is it ever a little frustrating to sort of see that go on when there's, you know, what you're feeling is there's a lot of other opportunities elsewhere, right?
Yeah, and that comes down to, we'll call it the crazy valuation syndrome.
Yeah.
And I know, you know, we've talked before, and you've mentioned about, I think it was Cisco's kind of your historical reference, where you, again, it was a fantastic stock, earnings kept growing, and but just the valuations were just way too high, and it had to, for lack of a better phrase, grow into its valuation.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that happens annually, daily, in the markets. It's the one thing that will continue to happen, you know, and it's just being aware of that and knowing when you are paying too much for something, and that's where, again, coming down to the what you're paying versus what you're getting scenario, and always having that in mind.
Yeah, and I think that's certainly key. And we also did make a little bit of reference to that in our Q1 commentary with Tesla being priced to perfect and how it kind of fell off towards the end of the year and into 2024, and served as a bit of a cautionary tale for what else is out there. And at the time of this recording in mid-April 2024, we're seeing a little bit of that so far. But you know, how long-lived that ends up being, I guess, is still out for debate. You know, in the near future, hopefully. And also in our Q1 commentary, we wrote about the change in expectations that investors are having around potential interest rate declines in 2024, with the consensus view becoming much less optimistic about rate cuts. How does that play into the decisions that you're making today? Are there beneficiaries to less cuts but a stronger economy, or the opposite?
Yeah, for sure. You know, having the higher rates for longer make the dividend payers less attractive. You know, as investors can get a decent return from simply owning a money market fund these days. Rate-sensitive sectors like utilities and real estate are affected, since any floating debt they have stays at a higher level, or debt that needs to be refinanced will need to be refinanced at a higher level, which is then going to eat into their company profits. And, you know, again, those types of names aren't big earnings growers. They're a pretty stable thing, and if a stable earner, but if you've all of a sudden increased your costs, it takes a bit of time for things to get passed along. You know, we are looking for the opportunity to invest in some of these names and sectors, but I think ultimately we're going to need to see a rate cut or have the central banks signal that they are going to definitively start cutting rates. And, you know, as we've talked about, and I think is in our quarterly, you know, that is getting pushed out consistently. So,
mm-hmm. And I mean, when we talk about rate cuts, often the mindset immediately goes to the U.S. Fed. But, you know, are there any differences that you're looking for in Canada that might indicate that maybe Canada is ahead in the prospect for interest rate cuts? Of course, we have a very different economy, and does that play a role into any of the decisions that you're making, Canada versus U.S.?
Not necessarily. No. No, it's, you know, the rate story, we have, you know, someone very good, Paul Simon, here, who's been correct on this story since, you know, November, December, when he was saying higher for longer is the way to go. So we're lucky to have him around to give us some guidance on the rate world.
Mm-hmm.
As for me, you know, like, a lot of it essentially comes down to earnings, estimate revisions, valuations, all of those things, which are kind of the primary drivers. And then there's the technical things, which, you know, you're hoping that when you start to see, like you did see some of the utilities and real estate starting to pop up and break out of their downward trends towards the end of November-ish. And so, you know, again, on the cusp of that, people were anticipating that. But that was a fairly short-lived trade.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, there were some changes that you made in the funds in the past 3 months. Can you speak to any of the additions that you made within the funds, or in funds that maybe, or positions in the funds that maybe you looked to exit?
Sure. Yeah. In both of the funds, we were adding to our energy holdings, as, you know, again, watching the trend stuff and the relative performance. The negative trend started to reverse in early March. And there was also, just from the fundamental side of things, more and more information was coming out about crude oil demand continuing to increase, and a number of supply issues were continuing along the globe, kind of putting a little bit more pressure on the resource. You know, some of the names we own in the energy space are Canadian Natural Resources, Enbridge, and Peyto. In the pension fund, we recently added Starbucks, so this was more of a valuation story, kind of what you're paying versus what you're getting. Starbucks is trading around 21 times earnings, which is about the U.S. market multiple right now. And, you know, 21 times earnings for Starbucks is close to the lowest levels in the last 10 years. Analysts are seeing about a 20% return over the next year. And earnings growth is projected to be somewhere in the mid-teens, which is more than double what the market's expecting from the market growth. So, you know, when you can go and buy something at a market multiple at the lowest valuation it's been at essentially in 10 years, and the projected growth is supposed to be double what the market is, then those are some of the attractive opportunities that we're looking for in the funds. We've also, you know, been a little bit more cautious recently. We've added a bit of cash to the funds. We also were hedging just yesterday, hedging some of our U.S. dollar exposure. And we've also done some things like a small derivative strategy to reduce portfolio volatility and any downside move.
Interesting. So one of the things we actually talked about a little bit offline was around, what does growth mean and what does value mean? And value, you made the point earlier today that people think that value is anything that's not growth, so anything that's not those big tech names. Can you maybe describe at a high level for anybody listening what value really is and where our focus is in that realm?
Yeah, and as it's something where, again, we don't have, I mean, the stereotypical value is essentially comes through to the what are you paying versus what are you getting, and making sure that you are at the low end of everything. It can come in multiple different ways. I mean, generally the easiest one is on like PE multiples, where the price to earnings and am I paying a low price for the earnings that I'm receiving from this company? But you can also do it off of like asset value, where I'm buying something and with some companies they could have a lot of cash sitting on the books, which could be a substantial portion of the value. It could be their real estate value underneath a bunch of their store holdings or things like that. So I mean, value can be a number of different things. It necessarily isn't something that we focus on here specifically to say, I'm going to go buy value stocks today. I mean, we're always looking for some form of a value, but there are times where you are going to, this is more for the growth fund, but you are going to pay a higher multiple for things and you are going to get higher growth. So I guess stereotypically, a lot of people would talk about the fact that growth stocks are tech stocks. And I think, as we mentioned earlier, utilities can be growth stocks. Commodities back in the early 2000s were the growth stocks of the day. Basically any sector, the financial stocks before that were the big growth engines. So essentially, it's people generally want to buy companies that have faster growing earnings than what they expect, but again, you can't go too far out that road. And there are people who essentially focus on the other side of the coin, which is just simply give me the cheapest, dirtiest, not dirtiest, but the cheapest stocks out there, which you have to be wary of. And those can lead to things like value traps, where they are cheap, but the reason they're cheap is because their earnings are going to be declining. And that's where if you can kind of pair things where you're getting a low valuation with, one thing that we look at here a lot is estimate revision. So if you have a low valuation, but estimate revisions are continuing to move up, then that's a positive sign that earnings are going to continue to grow and that there is the higher potential for a surprise on earnings, which, again, generally the market likes surprises. And for the most part, stocks get rewarded positively when a company comes out and reports earnings and those numbers surprise to the upside.
Yeah. And I mean, one of the points you made too around, growth companies are those that are growing their earnings, something that I found really interesting in 2023. And we talked a little bit about in our commentaries throughout the year. Well, for lack of a better term, we picked on was Apple, because Apple was the largest weight in the S&P 500. They were ascribed to this Magnificent Seven company, but or cohort, but they weren't growing all that much, which I found very interesting. They did have certain valuable assets underneath, like their cash that a lot of analysts point to. But I found that as a really interesting example of people pointing to it as a growth company, but not really understanding the behind the scenes of what that actually means.
Exactly. And that's, as you kind of talked about earlier with the things that drive me crazy. And that period too, where you're going and you're looking at all of these names and you look at what their growth is expected to be, and obviously things can change from there. But again, Apple's the primary example where, we just talked about Starbucks. And we've got Apple trading at a higher multiple than Starbucks, and earnings growth is expected to be half or a third of what it is. And it's like, well, so should Starbucks be in the Magnificent Seven now? Because it's some fan, it's all silly to talk about, but
Yeah, it's more marketing than anything else, right?
Exactly, exactly.
It's good to get you click on the financial news article on CNBC or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So two of the names that we talked a little bit about when we were doing the quarterly commentary, just as an example of sort of that high quality more on the value side for the pension fund was Exchange Income Corporation and Rogers Sugar. Can you maybe describe these two names a little bit as and speak to them as a little bit of an example of what's in the fund so people have an idea?
Sure. So Exchange Income Fund is they're a diversified acquisition-oriented company that focuses on aviation and industrial products. So basically, you know, this company owns 18 subsidiaries and most of it is around aviation. So they have pilot training schools. They do medevac services to Canada's North. They run a couple of airlines to Canada's North. They also have, you know, precision machine components for defense sector. So, you know, they're talking valuation is pretty fair, looking at about 14 times multiple. Earnings expected to be pretty modest and in line with the market. But over the next year or so, but 25-26, we should be getting back up into the mid-teens earnings growth. Analysts see about 30% upside over the next 12 months, and it has a 5.5% dividend yield. From a catalyst standpoint, they have a couple. One is that they're expanding current agreements to provide regional services for Air Canada, which would be good. They also have the possibility of taking over medevac services in Newfoundland and Labrador. So again, you know, these are non-discretionary types of things and they're services that need to get run. And there's also looking at, there's an aerial surveillance program contract that they're bidding for in the UK and also another one in Australia. So, you know, they have ways of diversifying, spreading themselves out. And a lot of their things are, you know, once you have the contract with the government, you know, as long as you do a good job, you're going to have that for a while. And it's a steady flowing income coming from there. So those are, you know, that's one name that we kind of like. Another one, Rogers Sugar. So this one is essentially, you know, they refine, package, market, and distribute sugar and maple products. Some people don't know about the maple products. In Canada, in the U.S., and Europe. Again, this would be one of our value plays. It's trading at the low end of earnings, trading at about 12 times earnings. So this allows for some multiple expansion where if you can just get people willing to pay a little bit more for it, you can make some money there. Analysts see about 17% upside over the next 12 months, and the company's paying close to a 7% dividend. So essentially, investors are getting paid to wait for a name like this. The company, as far as some of the catalysts, they just completed funding for an expansion of their Quebec facilities, which should come online in 2026 and be fully running in 2027. And that could result in, I think it's about a 20% growth in production, which the market seems like it could easily absorb. They also had a strike at their Vancouver refinery in early February, so they're still in the process of getting back online for that. And the company is also the world's leading bottler of maple syrup, with three plants in Quebec and one in Vermont. And the Maple Syrup Group has been working on a number of things, and they're looking at improving their margins, which they're hoping should come into effect, I think, around Q4 this year. So those are a couple of names and kind of some of the rationale behind.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's good to hear about names that I think a lot of people don't hear often about, and they're outside of sort of that tech FOMO space, right? But I'll blend together my next two questions around what are some of the themes that you're watching today, and are there any themes that are out there that you feel are less appreciated by the broader market?
So the one thing that I'm really trying to watch more now is the unemployment level. So when we saw the rate rise coming in, you know, rates get jacked up to hopefully slow down the economy, which then could potentially lead to job shortages, which then potentially leads to some unemployment there. And so the unemployment levels is a major thing here. You're starting to see them tick up a bit. We're still at some very historically tight levels of unemployment. But there have been a number of surveys that I've seen, one in for Canada and one for the US, showing that if you were to go back a year or two ago, one of the primary concerns of employers was finding good quality labor, and that's dropped down substantially. Mm-hmm. So there was this situation where employers were hoarding labor, and because they had such a poor experience after the COVID of letting people go and then trying to bring people back and not being able to find quality labor. So it seems as if companies may think there's quality people out there available, and so they may be a little bit more willing to start laying off people. So if they do that, then that's going to put pressure on the economy, I would think. So that's kind of my main one there, because that, as I say, would flow down to, you know, you've got a lot of people having some concerns with renewal of mortgage rates in Canada and what that's going to do to their, you know, their next mortgage and mortgage payments. If you lay a little bit more unemployment on top of that, that might just kind of exacerbate some things there.
Yeah, and you mentioned mortgage renewals, and I think it was 2025, 2026, they're supposed to be the big points there, because that's, of course, everybody who refinanced or took out a mortgage in 2021 when rates were at their all-time low, and of course, they're in for a bit of a shock coming up that renewal if rates haven't at least begun their trend downwards, right?
So, yeah.
So I think that's a good place to end it. Thanks again for joining me, Cam. For any listeners who have not already read our Q1 2024 market commentary, I would encourage you to visit the Insights page on our website. And that concludes this recording of Canadian Wealth Wisdom, and more specifically, our quarterly market update series.